From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 23rd day of May 2018. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Jackie Vague. She's at Stewart Peterson. We'll take an in-depth look at the agricultural news for the day, how trade is happening across the planet, some of the things that are going on with the farm bill. We'll also check in with Nick Sider, extension entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I made a trip out to the South Barms. And the research trials he's doing on the western corn rootworm. And then as we finish our time out together, we'll discuss the weather forecast. That with Drew Lerner at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. And it all happens on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We're now joined by Jackie Vakes of Stewart Peterson to take a look at the marketplace. Hey, Jackie, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
You know, the soybeans were a bit all over the place today before they ended the market. And that brings me to the thing you and I have talked about more than once. Actually, each week we put these out. So we're looking for those areas where the prices might go and get arrested at one point, either to the top side or the bottom side. What are the support and resistance levels today?
Well, when you look at July corn, resistance 408 and a quarter, supports at 394 and a quarter. July beans, 1040. You know, today we went up into that 1039 area, so we're right below it. 992 and a half for support. December corn, resistance has now become 429 and a half, which is the old contract high. And so I would think that there's probably a big target on that baby, and support at 396. November beans, 1060, like we've been dealing with all this while, although today, you know, we're up within about a dime of that, and support at 1002. So we're moving to the higher end, let's just put it that way. You know, isn't it surprising, Todd, when you look at perception in this market? I think that that's something that everybody has to recognize. Perception is what drives a great deal of this market. It's, you know, I've said it so many times, it's called a futures market because it's always looking at the future. So when the China talks started, we went down because everybody was scared to death. Now the China talks look like they're okay, and now we're coming back. So, you know, it can be very frustrating sometimes.
Yeah. Speaking of the China talks, we know that Sinograin and COFCO have both been feeling around the market, at least. That's probably good news. And that apparently that is on the behest of President Xi of China. It's interesting to have a president, and this is just part of the communist way of doing things, being able to tell the companies you will buy from here, but it looks like they're at least sniffing around some soybeans.
Well, they certainly are. In fact, there's talk out there that they bought 4 to 6 cargoes for August today and are actually asking for September prices. Another thing that seems to be a good thing that came out of this is that there are a lot of rumors, you know, that they may take 8 million metric tons of corn imports, which is a quota from the U.S., and I think that's amazing. They're talking like they're going to lower tariffs on cars from 25% to 15% in July, and, you know, they're going to try and reduce this trade deficit. They are going to do it by importing more ethanol, which is good for us, and liquefied natural gas. You know, so all in all, if everything comes true the way it looks like it's going to right now, this could be a very good thing for us.
So there are other items I want to take up with you really quickly that are supportive to the marketplace. At least I think they are, but you let me know. A couple of strikes in South America, the truck strike and apparently a port strike in Argentina too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. In Brazil, the truckers are striking. They were just protesting the high diesel prices. We've all heard about Petrobras. Well, Petrobras switched from what they call maintaining a predetermined price to market pricing. So now it is actually moving with the prices, and prices are up almost 50% compared to a year ago. And so this, of course, is having a huge impact on the truckers themselves. And when you look at the impact that it's having on the local markets and the import markets, the third largest poultry and pork processor is planning to close 15 plants on Thursday and Friday because they can't be certain that this perishable food is going to get to where it wants to go. So the government's promising they're going to bring down pump prices, they're going to reduce the taxes. We've heard all of this so many times before, but they really don't know how long this strike might go on because the truckers are just extremely upset. And then in Argentina, the ports are going to experience a 24-hour strike that's going to be on Thursday. They want better working conditions, and they're striking because the potential talks that Argentina is going to have with the International Monetary Fund, which I found that to be very interesting. Now, why would they be upset about that? Well, they're opposing it because a loan from the International Monetary Fund could come with some real belt tightening. Does this sound like Greece to you? I mean, this is the same type of situation that we saw happening in Greece. You know, they want the money, but they don't want to have to comply with whatever the requirements are going to be. So that, too, I think all of this is interesting because of the fact that we do know that China has been buying beans out of Brazil. And again, we go back to how reliable an exporter are these two countries.
Yeah, and some of this depends, I think, at least on China, first because they have to source from both North and South America in order to get as many beans as they want, or at least I believe they do.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it sometimes depends on the value of the real, and it's been changing, and for a long time it changes, but changes fairly radically sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It really does, and it has been doing that lately. And primarily what's happening now is the exchange rate has been going up between the real and the U.S. dollar, which we've talked about this before. How they get paid is based on U.S. dollars is what it is. And so the stronger the dollar is or the weaker the real is, the more valuable the beans are to them. And I thought it was kind of interesting. You know, we sometimes think that just on the 18th, they had a exchange rate of 3.75. That's an extremely high exchange rate. And beans were at 9.98, meaning they get 3,744 real per bushel. But today, the exchange rate is 3.65, but beans are at 10.38 and a quarter, so they're getting 3,789 real today. So even though the exchange rate has dropped off a little bit, the increase in the bean price is bringing them more money. And so this may shake loose some more of the old crop down there and possibly cause some forward contracting to come into place on new crop. All of those things are good for us. I expect that the real, Todd, is probably going to continue to weaken, primarily because of what's going on in Argentina. You know, the peso has just been going to pieces, basically. And those two countries kind of mirror each other. So I don't think that this is a one-time thing. I think this is something that's going to continue for a while.
Well, what's your assessment of the U.S. dollar in this case and maybe its support and resistance levels?
Well, when I look at the dollar, I'm looking at the June dollar, 94.42 is resistance. We're down a little bit from that. Supports at 91.60. Those are areas that we still have been able to export in, so that's what we really want to do. And, you know, with the economy chugging along the way it is, you have to expect that we're going to see a higher dollar. There's just no two ways about it.
Okay, so we've talked about currencies, both the real and the dollar. Where does the managed money look to put its cash at this point?
Well, the estimates for the moment are that we are about 200,000 contracts long on corn, 108,000 on beans, 113,000 on meal, and actually short 57,000 on soy oil. So they're betting their money on beans, meal, and corn. There's no question about that, which is always something that makes a person concerned because at some point in time, they will change their position. But for right now, they probably will battle to continue to support their position for a while. So that's a good thing. I mean, that gives us decent support. Let's just put it that way. It keeps us from going as low as we might go otherwise. But we have to keep a close eye on managed money. There's no question about it.
And finally, before I let you go, we should check in on the livestock. A cattle on feed report is due out Friday afternoon.
Yep, and I always like to watch that, too. I mean, we've got plenty of cattle people, but they're looking at 104.9% on feed, 91.1 placed, which isn't a big surprise, I guess, because we've got pretty lush pastures out there right now, and 106 marketed. So it looks like basically it'll be supportive. You know, supportive to the nearbys and maybe a little weakening on the deferreds, but I don't doubt if it'll be big.
Hey, it's always good to talk with you.
Thanks a lot, Todd. Have a great day.
Jackie Vakes, of course, is with Stuart Peterson. Hey, do visit our website, willag.org. There you can check out our calendar of events. We've got a couple of items coming up in the month of June. We should be at CUTC. That's the Corn Utilization Technology Conference at the beginning of the month. It takes place in St. Louis. Mid-month, we'll be in Galena with the Summer Beef Conference. That's for the Illinois Beef Association. Hope to see some of you there. Otherwise, if you've got events that you'd like us to come out and check out, please do let me know. You can do that at tgleason@illinois.edu or by giving me a quick phone call at 217-333-9697. That's 217-333-9697. Otherwise, check out where we're headed right there on our website at willag.org. Hit the calendar and you'll see what's coming up. Also, while you're there, be sure to visit and listen to all of our agricultural programming. Posted a couple of brand new things this week, including what you are about to hear, or at least one of the items you're about to hear from our news section, a video view of the information that comes from our extension entomologist, Nick Sider. So you'll want to check that out. He was out in the field earlier in the month putting in a western corn rootworm trial. And I caught up with him and talked with him a little bit. And you can see some of the equipment the University of Illinois uses on its research facilities. In today's agricultural news, China's state grain stockpiler Sinograin returned this week to the U.S. soybean market for the first time since early April. Sinograin made inquiries about prices for U.S. soybeans, interpreted as a sign that government curbs on buying American goods has been lifted. Sinograin is in the market today asking U.S. suppliers to make offers for shipment of old crop as well as new crop beans for shipment August onwards, said a source who works at a private soybean crushing company in China. It's a clear message to even private companies that it's okay now to import U.S. soybeans. Soybeans are America's top agricultural export to China, worth some $12 billion last year. Two other sources, according to Reuters, were briefed in on the matter, said the Chinese state grain trader Kofco would be permitted to buy U.S. soybeans again, ending restrictions imposed by Beijing as trade tensions rose. The sources declined to be named as they are not authorized to speak to the media. Sinograin, Kofco, and the Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Affairs did not respond to requests from Reuters for comment. Let's stay with trade for just a moment because Japan, Russia, and Turkey are the latest countries to notify the World Trade Organization of plans to retaliate against the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Japan calculated that the duties would add approximately $439.9 million in cost, while Russia calculated it at $537.6 million. Neither said which goods it would target, but both planned to respond with their own tariffs that would cost the U.S. roughly the same amount. Turkey said it would face about $266 million in additional charges and plans to target imports of products like nuts and rice from the United States. Let's stay in Washington, D.C., but we'll switch topics now. Top deputies from USDA, EPA, and the Energy Department will meet Thursday to hash out changes on the renewable fuel standard. USDA Deputy Secretary Stephen Sinski, EPA Deputy Administrator Andrew Wheeler, and the Department Secretary for the DOE will attempt to resolve longstanding tensions over the program. Speaking of which, looking forward, refiners next year may be expected to blend 500 million more gallons of advanced biofuels into the nation's fuel supply than they do under the proposed rule EPA sent to the White House last week. Speaking of which, on Friday, as you probably already well know, the Farm Bill came up for a vote in the House and it was defeated. So now it's stuck in something of a limbo. Freedom Caucus Chairman Mark Meadows continues to be coy about where his members stand on the bill. He told reporters yesterday he can't guarantee the caucus will band together and deliver the votes in favor of the sweeping farm policy legislation, or even after GOP leadership schedules a vote on a conservative immigration measure from Representative Bob Goodlatte. That was the demand from the conservative coalition that led to many caucus members voting against the Farm Bill last week. Acknowledging the Freedom Caucus's leverage, Meadows said, "I do know that based on the whip count the other day, that had we worked out our differences on immigration, there would have been enough to go from no to yes to pass it. Meadows added that it was problematic that a Republican Congress is not addressing which farmers should be eligible to receive commodity support payments from USDA. Meadows offered an amendment aimed at limiting subsidies, but it failed to make it to the floor debate. "I thought my amendment," he said, "would do the best job of making sure that farmers get subsidies and not big corporations." Still, Meadows said his amendment not getting tacked onto the farm bill is not the litmus test for supporting the bill. Meanwhile, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa plans to back a provision on the Senate side going after loopholes in farm subsidies, but said on Tuesday the fact that the House won't have a parallel provision weakens the effort by Congress to rein in what he calls large commodity handouts. We'll continue with the farm bill for just a moment. House Agriculture Chairman Mike Conaway, for his part, told Politico Tuesday he's keeping out of the whole political wrangling area for the moment. "We're really just on the sidelines, very interested, of course, on the sidelines." Asked if he thinks the Freedom Caucus will indeed deliver the votes for the farm bill after getting a vote on the good legislation for immigration, Conaway said, "A little iffy. Obviously, the Freedom Caucus folks have sold leadership on that idea." He did note, however, that several lawmakers suspected of being part of the caucus voted for the bill on Friday, suggesting there are divisions within that group. The Texas Republican did shed some light on why a number of moderate Republicans voted against the legislation, saying that they were anxious about some of the SNAP changes in the bill, such as removing broad-based categorical eligibility as an option for states, which makes it easier for low-income families to qualify in some cases. This puts the Farm Bill legislation in a tricky spot, much like that of the legislation which was put forth to kill Obamacare, with Republicans fighting on the moderate and conservative sides of the party and neither ending up with what they wanted and the legislation dying before it made it to the president's desk. And that is a look at today's agricultural news. You know, when farmers want to know how well an insecticide works, they turn to their land-grant university. I visited a Western corn rootworm trial on the Urbana-Champaign campus earlier this year. This little four-row planter is outfitted with some pretty high-tech stuff, all of which must be calibrated before it goes to the field where it'll be used to plant a Western corn rootworm trial. A trial that will assess how well 12 different current in-furrow liquid and granular insecticides work. Well, at least some of them are current products. Others are experimentals, says University of Illinois Extension entomologist Nick Sider.
We like to evaluate all the different options that are out there. There's always the potential that we could lose control tactics that we're using currently, and so we want to make sure that we evaluate everything so that if we lose something, we have good answers on sort of the next one up. But there are people using these products in the field right now, and we want to be able to get information out to them on how effective they are.
Illinois has long done research to test how well different control methods work on the Western corn rootworm. Naturally, these include the BT corn hybrids, too. As for the insect, well, it's really nimble and quite capable of adapting to all sorts of ways farmers use to control it, says Sider.
It's an insect that's very good at developing resistance to multiple different control tactics. And it's the one, out of all the insects we deal with, it's the one that growers are the most interested in terms of efficacy, in terms of what products, what hybrids, what control tactics are going to give them the best control.
On that account, Nick Sider from Illinois and his counterparts at land grants across the nation are working hard to stay up with the ever-changing Western corn rootworm and the products used to control it. The Closing Mark Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Glad to have you along with us on this Wednesday afternoon, the 23rd day of May. If you can stick around in a couple minutes, we'll be back. We'll talk about the agricultural weather forecast. That with Drew Lerner. He's at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. And we'll also ask you to join us on our website at willag.org. That's WILLAG.org. www.agriculturalinformationagency.org. There you can find all of our agricultural information. You can listen to us on demand anytime you'd like. Again, the address, willag.org. You can pick us up as a podcast, too. Look for us in Stitcher, the NPR One app, and, of course, SoundCloud. This is the closing market report for Wednesday afternoon. Drew Lerner is here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, on Monday, the United States Department of Agriculture made note that there were parts of Missouri, southwest parts of Iowa, that were suffering some dry conditions. I know farmers are concerned, actually, across a good portion of the Corn Belt about these. Can you maybe give me some details, please?
Yeah, it's certainly the precipitation that has occurred so far this month has definitely been limited across the area you've described. The focal area of dryness seems to be from northern Missouri and parts of southern Iowa into west central and southwestern Ohio. But Indiana, central and southern Indiana, and portions of central and southeastern Illinois seem to be at the core of the driest weather, at least for this month. And if we step back and look at the past 30 days, in general, it's kind of the same scenario with just a little more intensity in a few more areas. So this is, it's interesting to see this dryness evolving because of the fact that the soil moisture is still looking favorable in parts of this region. And we keep seeing the computer forecast models predicting rain that doesn't apparently verify very well. The thing that concerns me most is that we've been seeing some expansion of drought conditions from parts of the Central Plains into the southwestern Corn Belt in recent weeks. And with the dryness that's evolving across central and southern Indiana, as well as Illinois, you get the feeling that maybe this is going to expand further. We also have a dry area up in the north, up across parts of the region from the eastern Dakotas into northern Wisconsin, going right through the heart of Minnesota. And that area, it looks like they're going to get some rain as we go forward through the coming week. So that area probably wouldn't be as much of a concern as these areas in the lower Midwest.
You mentioned that soil moisture levels remain pretty good. What does it take, in your opinion, I suppose, because farmers are thinking to themselves, I know I've got enough soil moisture at the moment, but how long does it take before we kind of really get concerned about some of these areas?
Well, it's a function of temperature. So the hotter the temperatures are, obviously, the more evaporation that takes place and the quicker that you lose moisture from the soil. So let's say the temperatures are going to be in the 80s pretty consistently. We could probably go at least two full weeks and maybe a third without running very short on moisture in the subsoil. Now, the topsoil could dry out fairly quickly where we are running short to very short at the end of the second week under that scenario, if it didn't rain at all and temperatures were solidly in the 80s. What will probably happen, though, is we'll see scattered showers and thunderstorms occur to help slow that process down. And that's what usually helps us during the growing season. I do think that the rain amounts may be lighter than usual in some of this region, especially parts of Missouri and Illinois, as we go forward through this next week to week and a half. So I think there's reason to be concerned. And, of course, if temperatures get hotter, we get into the 90s, you can get in trouble a lot quicker, maybe in 10 days instead of 2 weeks. It could be a different situation.
And we don't have those concerns about temps at the moment?
Well, no, not completely. We will see temperatures in the lower 80s on a frequent basis across the Midwest. But like I said, we are going to have occasional showers and thunderstorms. So as long as we get at least some rain to occur while we're that warm, we'll probably break even or maybe just see a slow rate of some drying taking place overall for the whole period. So I don't think we're going to be in any deep trouble right away here. But the concern is on for later in the year because we're going to have a ridge of high pressure that will set up in the middle of the country. And that may tend to make Iowa and Missouri's dryness now a little bit more significant when we get to July.
Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
You too. That, of course, is Drew Lerner. He is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.